Okay, we were going through comparing Baptists to other groups identified as Christians, and if I'm not mistaken, we were ready to look for Methodism, and we had just mentioned how that John Wesley was used of God to call many people to a respect of the Scriptures and the concept of personal salvation. I believe many people genuinely got saved during the Wesleyan Revival. I would not be surprised to find out many people also got confused during it. But that's not radically different from the Independent Baptist movement today, frankly. Methodism was based on the basic fundamentals of the evangelical Christian faith. Basic fundamentals of the evangelical Christian faith. That's the second paragraph. And union together in a church system. And union together in a church system. They were called Methodists because of their emphasis on the methods they used. That's where the name comes from. And this system of church union is right away contrary to a Baptist distinctive, the autonomy of the local church. Methodist churches and individuals were left to decide many things for themselves. Most of them accepted the Bible as the final authority for faith and practice. They could not accept it as the sole authority because they also had the authority of their church system. They could not accept it as the sole authority because they also had the authority of their church system. Authority of their church system. Methodist churches have always been allowed more independence than most churches in a denominational system, but the final church authority is still with the denomination. Remember yesterday we used the example of the 72-year-old man been in the same Methodist church his entire life. The denomination assigns a homosexual pastor to the church, and he's mortified. And some of the other church members are mortified, and there's not anything they can do about it. Most of their churches practiced, most Methodist churches baptize infants and admit them to church membership. They baptize infants and admit them to church membership. Most of their churches practiced immersion, sprinkling, and pouring, leaving the choice to the individual. Historic Methodists usually hold only two church ordinances, baptism and Lord's Supper. Methodists historically have held the soul liberty, priesthood of believers, and separation of church and state. Today, many Methodist churches are dominated by modernists. Some of the more evangelical groups in the historic Methodist tradition are the Free Methodists, the Wesleyans, the Bible Methodists, the Nazarenes, and the Pilgrim Holiness. Most historic Methodists hold to Arminian doctrine, a belief you can lose your salvation. Most of them hold to Arminian doctrine, the belief that you can lose your salvation. I have heard of, but never met, what are called Calvinistic Methodists who believe in eternal security. I have heard such groups exist, but 40 years of being a preacher, I've never met one. Pentecostalism. Boy, this comes up all the time. I just got asked this yesterday. What's the difference between Baptists and Pentecostals? Also known as the Charismatic or Tongues Movement. Pentecostalism has been an important force in evangelical Christianity during the 20th century. Pentecostals believe they still manifest the apostolic gifts today. And that is the critical difference. They believe the apostolic gifts, tongues, healing, drinking poison and not being harmed, being bitten by poisonous snakes and not being harmed, etc. They believe that is still for today. This is a conversation I have often. It's not unusual for pastors to have it often, but we have a Christian school that is open to the public, and probably 50% of the students in our Christian school are charismatic. So this is a question from charismatic churches. This is a question that just comes up every year. And we have a couple of families that attend our church where the husband and wife are split. One's a Baptist and the other's charismatic. And they go back and forth between our church and a charismatic church. I mean, these questions just come up a lot. Pentecostals disagree on many points, including one we call the Baptist distinctives. No Pentecostal group can ever, however, can hold to the idea of sole authority of Scripture for faith and practice. By definition, because they're Pentecostal, they believe you're still getting divine revelation today. So there is no such thing as a Pentecostal Baptist. There is no. Some groups are closer than others. The Assembly of God actually holds to the other Baptist distinctives. But nobody that believes they're getting revelation from God can claim the Bible is their only authority. No Pentecostal group, however, can hold to the idea of sole authority of Scripture for faith and practice because they believe they still receive supernatural revelations from God. And boy, this is a huge issue in local churches here in the States. You go to the mission field, it's a huge issue. Lots of charismatics on the mission field or charismatics in other church in other countries have learned to call themselves Baptists for one reason. Baptists are where the money is. Okay? Baptists are the ones pumping money into national pastors and foreign missionaries. And so you'll find a lot of charismatics call themselves Baptists. But if you were to begin to question them, they're not Baptists, they're Pentecostals. And my Baptist history book, which relates a lot to these notes, not completely, but a lot, been translated into Arabic. And the folks that translated it said they believed they had identified 3,000 Baptist preachers in the Arab world, and they wanted to give each one of them this book, Faithful Baptist Witness. So they translated it into Arabic with my permission, printed 3,000 copies, gave a copy to every preacher they felt that identified, and then I began to get all kinds of negative feedback from folks, Baptists they had given this to in Jordan and Iraq and so forth, because of what I said about the charismatic movement. Many of these folks, everybody I got negative feedback from, and obviously many in the group were actually charismatics. They were using the name Baptist because that's where the money is. And so when you deal with this kind of thing, you have to be careful and you have to get some good information from the folks that you're considering helping. I've been blessed 15 trips to the Philippines, and some of my dearest friends in the world are Filipino pastors. But I will tell you, I've come across some Filipino churches bearing the name Baptist that are Pentecostal. And you can tell why they call themselves that. Same thing's true in India. And I mean, just all over the place. Traditionalist Protestant groups. Such groups as the Lutherans, Episcopalians, and Anglicans came out of the background of the Reformation in Europe. Came out of the background of the Reformation in Europe. They all have the influence of evangelical truth in their background. All of the influence of evangelical truth in their background. Historically, however, their emphasis on church tradition has kept them from agreeing with any of the Baptist distinctives. Denominational church structure, infant baptism, sprinkling, union of church and state, and the concept of a restricted priesthood are common to all three groups. All three groups are heavily influenced by modernism and are theologically corrupt. Heavily influenced by modernism and theologically corrupt. And this is what happens when you discover some truth but you're not committed to the sole authority of Scripture. Martin Luther did preach justification by faith. And if I think to bring it in, he had a seal, a symbol made up representing himself, and has salvation by faith in that seal. I try to remember to bring that in the Baptist heritage chart. But within a generation, Lutherans are preaching salvation by baptism. I mean, his emphasis on salvation by faith, it lasted among some, but it didn't last for the whole group for more than one generation. Pseudo-Christian cults. Many groups have originated in America which claim to be the only true expression of Christianity. Some examples include Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, The Way, Christian Science, and Unity, and there are literally hundreds of other examples. Organizations that start and claim to be true Christianity, and yet they're so far from the faith that people that believe what they believe aren't saved. I mean, they're not only not pure Christianity, they're not Christianity at all, but they have a Christian name. Well, because these movements use the Bible, These groups all deny the true deity and messiahship of Jesus Christ. They all deny the true deity and messiahship of Jesus Christ. And salvation by faith. Salvation by faith in His death, burial, and resurrection. Consequently, there's no common ground between these groups and historic Baptists, none. You might debate under what circumstances you might fellowship with a Bible Presbyterian or a Charismatic. And because of the controversies of the day, many of us would come to the point where we say rarely, if ever. But you could never debate whether you had fellowship with these groups. There would be no common ground at all. Because these movements use the Bible, they will occasionally teach one of the truths that Baptists emphasize. Some examples would include the Mormons on baptism by immersion. And I don't mean by that they teach any semblance of truth about baptism as a picture of salvation, but they do believe you get immersed under the water. Okay? And priesthood of believers. They do teach that everybody's a priest, and they claim they're the only ones that teach that, but that's certainly not the truth. Jehovah's Witnesses on separation of church and state. And I would say some of the absolutely best material I've ever seen on separation of church and state is produced by the Seventh-day Adventists. Truth they stumbled on. Separation, church and state. However, there's never been any basis for fellowship or mutual recognition between these groups and Baptists because they take entirely different approaches toward Christian truth. Entirely different approaches toward Christian truth. And this is one of the reasons, and it's unpopular with lots of people don't understand it, why I cannot support, be around, or be involved with a Billy Graham or a Franklin Graham crusade anywhere. Because they're open to participation from all these groups. And in the early days of Billy Graham's ministry, all of these groups would criticize the crusades. And then they discovered something. It gets you public respectability. You're not thought of as being a cult. And so now they flock, most of them flock to participate in a Graham crusade. And so here you are, if you fellowship in one of those crusades, here's a preacher, pastor sitting on a platform with the Seventh-day Adventist pastor down the road and the Mormon leader, and etc. Jehovah's Witnesses still don't participate, but Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons flock to these things. And what happens then when you try to get up and teach your folks that Mormonism is a cult? When you just participated in an evangelistic crusade with them. You can't make that message stick. And this, you know, illustrated by the Franklin or Graham crusade in the Philippines of 2-3 years ago. And there was a lot of pressure. These folks coming in, they really pressure every church in the area to participate. And I was there right before the Franklin Graham Crusade, I think it was 3 years ago. And they persuaded about half the independent Baptists to go in the thing, which was very disappointing to me. And, of course, it was also sponsored by Roman Catholicism. And Roman Catholics have learned to gain respectability through working in Graham Crusade. So I remember preaching at a preacher's meeting there and asking this question. If Roman Catholicism is legitimate Christianity, and 98% of the Filipino people were Roman Catholic in the 1940s, why did we go over there and bother them with missionaries? If that's legitimate Christianity, why didn't you just leave them all alone? They were all Christian. And that's an unfortunate thing, but that has become an issue of the day. We had, not with Billy Graham, but I can't remember, Greg Laurie was the guy in Chicago a few years back, and they had a similar crusade, and everybody was involved. And one particular church was really promoting it. And, I mean, they must have called me a dozen times because they really wanted to get some Baptists involved. There aren't that many Baptists in Chicago. But they really wanted some Baptists involved. And they called me and called me and called me and said, this isn't going to happen. Okay? I said, I have trouble working with half of the independent Baptists because they're not clear in the gospel. I mean, I sure don't have any question about Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and Seventh-day Adventists. I don't have any confusion about that. And I don't have any confusion about Catholics. We are not teaching the same thing about how to go to heaven. And years back, I was in Indianapolis, and there was a similar thing. It was Billy Graham this time. And they keep calling and, you know, trying to get me to participate and hope that I can influence some of the other independent Baptists to participate. I said, I'm not interested in this. And I said, well, tell you what. I said, write down your position on the Bible and on salvation. I said, what's your stand on the Bible and what's your stand on salvation? I said, I can work with people. Okay, they kept saying, we have to have a united testimony for Christ. I said, in some circumstances, I can work with people with whom I share the same position on the Bible and on salvation. So put it in writing, what you believe about how people get to heaven. Seems to me that's pretty basic. Okay, there's some things we can disagree on. How people get to heaven seems to me to be pretty important in an evangelistic meeting. And your position on the Bible. And of course, the answer is we don't have a position on those things because that would be divisive. I said, so why, how are we having an evangelistic crusade if we do not agree on what the gospel is? And I'm not talking about, you know, a little fuzzy in some of the details. I'm talking about dramatic difference. Like, do you get saved by trusting in the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, or do you get saved by working through the Catholic Church? That's a pretty significant difference. Okay. And a lot of times it'll be people don't understand. Why can't we all get along? Why can't we work together? And why can't we do this? And why can't we do that? For a number of years, 11, I was a professor at Indiana Baptist College in Indianapolis. And one of my jobs during part of that time was helping graduates find positions. So we had a Baptist church out in a small town come to us looking for a pastor, and I helped him get connected with a man that was graduating that year, and he was a little bit older and ready to tackle a pastorate. So he went out there, and, oh, I don't know, a few months later, I got a request. The church board wanted to come to Indianapolis and meet with me about the pastor I had sent them. They were obviously not happy. So I agreed to a meeting, and they come in, and we're sitting in the office together, and they said, we want you to straighten out this pastor you sent us. So what's the problem? He said, every year, our testimony to the community is the churches all in the town all come together for a joint Easter service. And said, there are three of us. There's a Methodist church and a Catholic church and us. So every year, one church provides the building, a different church provides the choir, and the other church provides the preacher. And then we rotate. And I said, this year, it's our church's turn to provide the building, and the Methodist church's turn to provide the choir, and the Catholic priest turned to preach. And to that pastor you sent us, won't let the Catholic priest preach in our church. I said, well, hallelujah. What exactly is the problem with that? And they said, well, it messes up our community, our testimony to the community. I said, does the Catholic preach the same thing about going to heaven that your pastor does and that your church believes? And said, well, it's not about that. It's about a united testimony. A united testimony about what? Okay. And he had some adventures at that church, as you can imagine, with a board that wasn't any sounder than that. I can imagine being a new pastor and him coming and saying, by the way, on Easter, the Catholic priest is preaching here. You can just imagine. Well, speaking of Catholics, Roman numeral 4. Doctrinally, Baptists and Catholics are two opposite forms of professing Christianity. On every single Baptist distinctive, we're at the opposite from Roman Catholicism. Protestantism is a compromise between the two. Wendell Roan has written, a careful comparison of the doctrines of the various denominations will show they occupy a middle ground somewhere between the Baptists and the Catholics. If one would take all the doctrines and practices which are decidedly Catholic in origin from these denominations, nothing would be left but the doctrines and practices of Baptists. On the other hand, if all the doctrines and practices which are decidedly Baptist in origin were taken from these denominations, nothing would be left but the doctrines and practices of Catholics. There are two opposite forms of professing Christianity. When talking with Pastor Scudder about this class and the one in the fall, we debated about how to do this. And in some Bible colleges, you would get a class on Baptist heritage and nothing on church history in general. In others, you would get a class on church history in general with a little Baptist history thrown in over the two semesters. And some you'd get a class on church history in general that would act like Baptists never existed. But we decided to do it this way, a class on true New Testament churches and a class on professing Christianity. This is the class on true New Testament churches. In the fall, there'll be a class on professing Christianity. That will largely be probably the first week, the history of Catholicism, and then the history of those movements that come out of Catholicism. It is the opposite of Baptists on all of these points. Roman numeral 5, Baptists have brought a heritage of liberty to the world. Baptists have never been persecutors. George Truett, May 1920, sermon at the Southern Baptist Convention, said, Baptists have one consistent record concerning liberty throughout all their long and eventful history. They have never been a party to oppression of conscience. Okay? Find one example in history of Baptists persecuting somebody for their religious faith. Okay? We understand you cannot make somebody be a Christian. You cannot make somebody trust Christ. You make somebody go to church, but you can't make somebody trust Christ. You can't make somebody love the Lord. Find a historical example of somebody, of a Baptist. And even the modernist Baptists seem to get this. Referring back again to my tour of American Baptist Convention headquarters, they had a whole room dedicated to separation of church and state, religious liberty. Now, you didn't find any Bible verses quoted in it, but nonetheless, they were still dedicated to the idea of religious liberty. Even the worst Baptists get this. Not an example. He said in 1920, I'll say it in 2014, show me an example of a Baptist involved in persecuting people for their religious beliefs. Even, and we'll mention this later, even during the Salem witchcraft trials, Baptists defended those that were on trial for witchcraft, largely because there was no proof being offered, just they had weird religious practices. We're steadfastly opposed to anybody being persecuted for weird religious practices for several reasons. Here's one. What do you think the world thinks of our religious practices? Well, they have forever been unwavering champions of liberty, both civil and religious. Their contention now in and has been, and please God must ever be, that it's the natural and fundamental and indefeasible right. It is the natural and fundamental and indefeasible right of every human being to worship God or not. That was natural, fundamental, and indefeasible, and I'll spell that since it's not a common word. Indefeasible. Indefeasible. It means undisputed. It was a more common word in 1920 than today. The natural, fundamental, indefeasible right of every human being to worship God or not according to the dictates of his conscience. As long as he does not infringe upon the rights of others, he is to be held accountable to God alone. Held accountable to God alone for all religious beliefs and practices. Held accountable to God alone for all religious beliefs and practices. Our contention is not for mere toleration, but for absolute liberty. Not for mere toleration, but for absolute liberty. And that, by the way, is an issue right in the forefront in the United States today. The philosophy of the Obama administration, and they've even used the word, is toleration. In other words, Sunday morning you can worship however you want to, but we'll tell you whether or not you want to provide abortion coverage to your employees, for example. Toleration, not liberty. Well, Truett said, our contention is not for mere toleration, but for absolute liberty. I got very involved some years back during my second pastorate. I was not far from Amish country. And the state of Indiana was coming after the Amish about their schools. And I have no sympathy with Amish doctrine. They teach salvation by works as clearly as anybody I've ever been acquainted with. But the state wanted to come in and regulate their schools. And I did what I could to be a help to them. And we fought a battle that was victorious. And by no means was I the only person in it, but I was involved in it. And people would ask, well, why are you helping the Amish? Because I'd say, I have one question. Whose children are they in their schools? Are they the state's? Are they the Amish? And the big fuss the state had was because they didn't have electricity in their school buildings. They don't believe in electricity. And in talking with some of the folks from the state and county, I said, look, they live 24 hours a day in homes without electricity. Right? That's their religious conviction. Trust me, I consider it a bizarre one. Electricity goes out at my house, I'm frustrated pretty quick. Well, electricity out for about 2 hours the other day. I was just pacing the halls, you know. And didn't have enough light to read, couldn't get on the internet. We have portable phones, which are all electric in nature. And, I mean, I'm just couldn't watch TV. And when do we get electricity back on? I mean, I like electricity. I think it's a wonderful invention. But they have the right to their religious conviction, no matter how bizarre their religious conviction is, as long as they're not hurting someone. And they're not hurting someone. And question, well, whose children are they? And if you start telling churches what they can and cannot do, where does that stop? There's a wide difference between toleration and liberty. Toleration implies somebody falsely claims the right to tolerate. Toleration is concession, is a concession, while liberty is a right. Toleration is a concession, while liberty is a right. Toleration is a matter of expediency. It's a matter of expediency. While tolerance is a matter of expediency, while liberty is a matter of principle. It's a matter of principle. Toleration is a gift from man, while liberty is a gift from God. There should be a quotations mark right after the word God there. Somehow got missed. Toleration is a gift from man, while liberty is a gift from God. Baptists have consistently stood for pure religious liberty, both for themselves and for others. Baptists have consistently stood for pure religious liberty, both for themselves and for others. I am for liberty for the Mormons. I am for liberty for the Seventh-day Adventists. I happen to think Mormon doctrine and Seventh-day Adventist doctrine are classic examples of the worst heresies you could come to. But if you can tell the Mormons what they can believe, the state can, then they can tell everybody else what to believe. When I was on staff at Indiana Baptist College in Greenwood, Indiana, people were getting really tired of the Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on their doors endlessly, and I can appreciate that. So they passed an ordinance in Greenwood that specifically forbid Jehovah's Witnesses from going door to door. And I opposed it and fought against it, even though I don't much care for Jehovah's Witnesses coming to my door either. But if you can start out by telling the Jehovah's Witnesses what they can do about their kind of evangelism, where does that end up? Okay. Certainly I had no sympathy with what Jehovah's Witnesses teach when they go door to door. But religious liberty is religious liberty. End of story. Well, John Locke described the contribution of the Baptists when he wrote in his famous essay on toleration. John Locke is writing in the 1700s. He influenced many of the founders of the United States. And he had an essay on religious toleration that became extremely famous. It's still in print today after all these years. The Baptists were the first propounders of absolute liberty. Absolute liberty. Just and true liberty. Absolute liberty, just and true liberty, equal and impartial liberty. Absolute liberty, just and true liberty, equal and impartial liberty. And then we go back to Wendell Roan, who has a long discussion of this. Because of their consistent and unyielding stand, Baptists have sealed this doctrine of soul liberty with their blood. The bloods of their Anabaptist progenitors lie in martyrs' graves in the Alpine valleys. That's the Valdenses that we talked about yesterday. While their ashes have flitted over the pavements of Smithfield on the winds for centuries. That's England, which we haven't got to yet, but we will. The sighs and sobbings of Baptists suffering for conscience' sake, haunting the coal hole of Lambeth Palace, again England, as the Lollards Tower and Bedford Jail, we'll get to all that. The dungeons in Lollards Tower to this day. Bedford Jail in England was the home of the immortal John Bunyan for 12 long, weary years because he would not compromise his religious views. John Bunyan's famous for the books he wrote, including Pilgrim's Progress. They were written in prison. You know why he was in prison? Wouldn't take a license to be a preacher. There was a 6-year prison sentence. They put him in prison for 6 years because he would not take a license to be a preacher. At the end of 6 years, he'd served his term and was released. And the next Sunday, he preached, still an unlicensed preacher in a church, and they put him back in prison for 6 years. He was released after having served his 6-year term. And guess what he did the next Sunday? He preached as an unlicensed preacher. They put him in jail again, but 6 months into his third sentence, they did away with the law and requiring preachers to be licensed, and he was released. But he served 12 and a half years rather than violate his conviction on religious liberty. I'm not sure we got many John Bunyans today. In England was the home of the immortal John Bunyan for 12 long, weary years because he would not compromise his religious views. Coming over into America during colonial times, we find Henry Dunster, the first president of Harvard University, being removed from his office because he objected to infant baptism. Very first president of Harvard studied the issue, came to a conclusion that infant baptism was wrong, and they fired him as the president of Harvard for it. Roger Williams, the apostle of religious liberty, was banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony because of his belief in religious liberty and freedom of conscience. Dr. John Clark was put in prison, and Obadiah Holmes was publicly whipped on Boston Common for meeting with others to worship God. Baptists had their lands confiscated and their goods sold to erect a house of worship and pay the minister of another denomination in Connecticut. Fines and imprisonments were everywhere in evidence in Virginia as the persecution rose against the Baptists for conscience' sake. It'll be next week before we get to it, but one of my favorite stories of Baptist history. Three Baptist preachers get arrested in the colony of Virginia for preaching without a license. Patrick Henry, pretty famous advocate of freedom, was a Presbyterian, but he got upset when people were persecuted for their religion. And whenever a Baptist got arrested for preaching without a license in Virginia, Patrick Henry, probably most famous man in the colony, along with George Washington, Patrick Henry would volunteer to represent them for free. And some say he arrived late on purpose, but these three preachers were on trial, and the prosecution has been presenting its case and, you know, is proving they preached without a license. There's no question they did it, and they acknowledge that. And Patrick Henry comes in. And the whole place goes quiet. The arrival of such a famous man. Pensacre Henry walks in, picks up the copy of the indictment, and apologizes for coming in late, and says, let's see what the issue is here today. And he starts listing all the problems the Virginia colony has, all the serious difficulties they have, bandits on the highways, pirates in the ports, and all that. And he says, and what have we here? 3 men arrested for preaching the gospel of the Son of God. Then he starts out again, but all the serious things that need to be dealt with by the Virginia government and all the problems that were affecting the people, and you're not safe from the Indians on the frontier. And he said, and what are we dealing with here today? 3 men arrested for preaching the gospel of the Son of God. And then he does a third round. And he says, and what are we dealing with all the problems we have to face? What are we dealing with here today? 3 men arrested for preaching the gospel of the Son of God. Jury finds him innocent. Okay? And jury nullification. I mean, it really is the point. How stupid can you get? You know, modern update on that. Brian would recognize this name. The rest of you might not. But Clarence Doyle starts a youth camp down in Indiana. And he puts up a sign. You know, it says this is a youth camp, Baptist youth camp. And the county says, we have a no-sign ordinance for this region. You can't put up signs. And they told him to take it down, and he didn't. And they take it to court. And the county prosecutor is up. This man's in violation of the sign ordinance. And Brother Doyle gets up. I'll never forget it. He's just rubbing his head the whole time. You'd have to know him. Right? But he's rubbing his head. He's, Your Honor, so I don't know anything about signs and ordinances. Just trying to help some young people. There's young people around here who need help, but I'm just trying to help some young people. And how are they going to know the camp's here if I can't have a sign to put it up and tell them the camp's here? I'm just trying to help some young people. And the judge looks at the prosecutor and says, with all the problems we have in this county, drugs, drug gangs, and violence, I said, with all the problems we have in this county, you have time to go after this preacher for putting up a sign? Case dismissed. You'd be amazed what happens sometimes when folks stand up for what's right. Well, and the reason I thought of that, we're just about to get to mention to the name. Fines, imprisonments were everywhere in evidence of Virginia's persecution rose against the Baptists for conscience sake. John Waller, Lewis Craig, and James Childs languished in the Fredericksburg jail for 43 days, and the only charge against them was for preaching the gospel not according to the established church. Yet the Baptists persisted. The Baptists persisted. And finally secured the adoption of the First Amendment to the Constitution in 1789. The First Amendment to the Constitution, which includes religious liberty, which was later adopted by all the states in the Union at that time and became part of the Constitution in 1791. So that's our comparison of Baptists and other groups that are called Christian. And not include every group, but certainly the best known. Some of the other groups that are a little closer to the truth would be like the Plymouth Brethren and the Grace Brethren and some folks like that. And you could still find the differences. The Grace Brethren believe, for example, in 3 ordinances, as do the Plymouth Brethren. And a third ordinance for them is foot washing. So, I mean, there's a difference, but it's not as extreme as some of the other differences.